Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Good afternoon and good evening. Sitting in for Peter Schiff, my name is Neeraj Chaudhary. I am an investment consultant with the Los Angeles branch of Euro Pacific Capital. My co-host this evening will be Hemanth Kothuria, who is the branch manager here in Los Angeles. And we are coming to you live from the Los Angeles branch. It is a beautiful day today, and I hope it is a beautiful day where you are as well. We've had quite an interesting week since the last time that we joined you for this program. Probably the biggest news over the past week, at least for fans of Euro Pacific Capital, has been the excitement about Peter's Senate run in Connecticut. As you know, as you probably know, Peter has decided that he is really going to take a very serious look at serving in the United States Senate as the Senator from Connecticut. He has formed an exploratory committee. He has not made the final decision as yet, and what he's doing right now is sort of gauging the climate there to see what kind of support he can garner for what is bound to be a very exciting time. And, of course, as many of you know, the purpose of this run is really to try and reintroduce some sound policies in the U.S. government. The debt and the deficits that we have been running for the past generation or longer have only gotten worse under the Obama administration. And like-minded individuals such as Peter and other folks who are sort of adherents to sound money are appalled at this, as we are at Euro Pacific. We are looking around and seeing the Bush policies. People ask for change. They're getting change. The change is the Bush policies on steroids. You're seeing deficits being run far above 10% of GDP, 15% of GDP, maybe longer. And it's really scaring people because we've already been in uncharted. Those uncharted waters are becoming even more choppy. This is really what's been happening over the past 12 months or so as the world looks around and realizes that all of the dollars that they're holding, the trillions and trillions of dollars in these sovereign wealth funds, are effectively worthless. They're basically monopoly money. And we are heading over a cliff economically. And Peter has looked around, and a lot of folks have been encouraging him to get involved in the political arena. And I think he has really stepped up and decided that at the very least, he wants to take a very, very serious look at this. And he has established an exploratory committee for that purpose. There is a website that you can go to. The website is called, the link is www.schiffforsenate.com. Now, for reasons that are related to election law and other restrictions, we are not able to discuss the details of his potential candidacy in detail, other than to say that obviously we're very excited by this because this is a real opportunity to give the voters, at least in the state of Connecticut, and potentially, the voices of other voters in the country, to be heard in the way of donations. So if you visit shiftforsenate.com, you're going to see a tremendous amount of information there. You're going to see some discussion there of what Peter is hoping to accomplish and what his motivations are. And there's also an opportunity to support the candidacy if you choose to do so. So please do check out that website. For the purposes of this show today, Hemanth and I are going to focus in on the things that we have always focused in on, which are basically investments, excuse me, and economic outlook. And that's basically where we are. I'd like to take this opportunity now to introduce Hemanth. Hemanth, thanks for joining us. Hemanth is, just to give you a quick intro, Hemanth has hosted the show in the past couple of times. He has been friends with Peter for more than 20 years. He was Peter Schiff's college roommate at UC Berkeley when they were students there, and they've kept in touch ever since. And a couple of years ago, the opportunity arose for them to work together, and they did so. And shortly thereafter, Peter asked Hemanth to open up the Los Angeles branch of Euro Pacific Capital, and I've come to work for Hemanth. I've also known Peter for almost 20 years, and it's my great pleasure to introduce Hemanth today.
How you doing, nerds?
Good.
Well, it's probably the top question on everybody's mind. What is the Schiff for Senate campaign going to do for the firm? Well, the firm and the campaign are two separate animals altogether. So let me just put that fear to rest right away. I've received several emails today, as well as Neeraj and all the other brokers in the branch, as well as the firm. So we want to concentrate on what we do best, which is follow the markets, follow the dollar, follow gold. I mean, right now it's an exciting time. We've seen tremendous action in the markets. I was looking this morning at a chart of the U.S. dollar index, and what did I see? It was the classic pennant formation to the downside. It looks like we are breaking down from that, a continuation pattern. The U.S. dollar index is headed lower as we speak. The gold market and the gold stocks in particular are doing exactly what we expect them to do at this time of year. If you look back over 30 years of history, you'll find that the phrase sell in May and go away is something that did not come about just out of the air. The markets typically do pull back in the summertime, especially the gold market. And if any of you who are listening today got the opportunity to listen to the show that I did last September, I talked a lot about gold market corrections and what causes them. So the seasonal patterns are very strong. I expect that the move up today that we saw in gold, as well as the gold stocks, will continue. But this is really a base building period. As far as a push through 1,000 and through 1,030 and onwards over to 1,200 and 1,500 and above, that is something that we are going to see. It's just a matter of time. I'm thinking that we should chop higher here. It's going to be very, very volatile. If you do not have a position in the gold market, I encourage you to try to buy all dips. What we've been doing for clients who are, you know, literally paralyzed and unable to make decisions. We've been either buying the physical gold first through our Perth Mint program or using limit orders on some of the gold stocks and even some of the senior mining stocks which trade here, which Peter may own in his own account, and I own a few of them in my own account. We've been buying their convertible bonds, so Newmont Mining, Kinross, the names that you all know. So there is no reason that you should not have already established a position in gold mining shares. If you have not established a position, I encourage you to do so. You should call in to your local branch. There are brokers standing by both in the Newport Beach branch and the Los Angeles branch. Just go to europac.net, and you'll see the individual branches have their numbers. If you are on the East Coast and you want to contact one of your brokers, the number is 800-727-7922. Newport Beach is 800-993-8350. You can call LA at 310-826-2975. Now, the questions that any of you might have regarding the markets, We'll be happy to entertain those. I want to talk a little bit to Neeraj for a second, though, because he is rapidly become known within our branch and probably within the firm as one of the most patient individuals. And so one of the things I wanted to do today before we take calls is just try to get an idea of why you would have a fear to pull the trigger. Now, when I mean pull the trigger, I mean take that initial position, get that account open with Euro Pacific Capital, get in some foreign dividend paying stocks, get in some foreign currencies, get in some foreign bonds, take a position in the precious metals, commodities, et cetera, the kind of things that you just need to do in an environment where not only has our central bank created $11 trillion, but the world's central banks are following through. All of you have heard of the China stimulus and how the market there is doing tremendous. The appreciation of the renminbi over the last 5 years has temporarily slowed, but we expect that that it's going to ramp up in earnest. So this is an opportunity for you to take advantage of our research, get positioned through the Hong Kong market or the Singapore market in the actual economies that are growing. I mean, even throughout Europe, you've got you can't paint it with the same brush. Now, people will say, well, Europe's a basket case, I'm afraid to invest. You know, that's not true. Look at Norway, look at Finland, look at some of the countries that have positive GDP growth, and they have a growth in their capital reserves. You look at some of the individual names within those countries, and you've got to establish a beachhead. You've got to put something in your account at Europac or in any other means that you have available to you sooner rather than later. These summer months where you see the gold mining shares pull back, you saw that brief consolidation we had in the dollar, and now it looks like it's already starting to break down again. Don't let that stop you. You can't hesitate any longer. You need to get positioned. I mean, Neeraj, what do you think about that?
You know, I could not agree with you more. I know I speak with clients daily, and by the way, thank you for those kind words. I speak with clients daily who struggle with this very question as to, you know, what to do. What we are now in an unprecedented period of deficit spending and monetary growth. The monetary base of the United States has doubled just during the Bernanke chairmanship. So we are in uncharted territory. We are engaging in unprecedented fiscal and monetary stimulus. And yet, at the same time, we're seeing deflation in the asset prices, specifically in real estate and stock prices, at least in the United States. And so people are confused. On the one hand, you've got some highly, highly inflationary trends. On the other hand, you've got prices that are not responding. And people are saying, well, when is this inflation going to kick in? And what I tell people is that the problem with not knowing what's going to happen and not being able to predict things is that they are truly not predictable. Just as an example, back on March 18th, the Federal Reserve announced they were going to be monetizing Treasury debt along with some other securities. On that very day, within about 30 or 40 minutes, the price of gold jumped by about $60 or $70 per ounce. And within the next trading day, the U.S. dollar was down several percentage points. So that's a perfect example where on March 17th, people were not sure what to do. The same trends have basically been in place for several months. And boom, the Federal Reserve comes out and announces that they're going to monetize Treasury debt, which I don't think very many people expected based on the market's reaction. And gold was up sharply. The dollar dropped. So the problem with where we are right now is that there are going to be events that will take place that cannot. The problem is that we know that they are going to take place. We just don't know how and when they're going to unfold. But we know the trends are there. A perfect example of this is the Treasury auctions. A couple of weeks ago, we auctioned off a little over $100 billion of 2, 5, and 7-year notes. And that was the first time in history that we had ever auctioned off that many securities in that short a period of time. It was literally within a couple of days. And furthermore, we're going to be doing those Treasury auctions every single week through September 30th, which is the end of the government's fiscal year. Now, for the past couple of weeks, those auctions have gone off well. The bid-to-cover ratios have been well within historic norms. Interest rates have generally been stable to down. But I make the argument that if we come along in a couple of weeks, maybe when people get back from summer vacation, or maybe sooner, or maybe later, if we come around in the next couple of weeks and all of a sudden we have a bad Treasury auction, that could very easily cause some disruption in the U.S. dollar and markets globally, especially in regards to U.S. equity prices.
Well, I think you hit the nail right on the head there. I mean, a lot of people take the immediate term action in the market as some kind of indication of where they need to be, and so they think that that the markets are going sideways, the dollar app is not plunging daily, and the gold market hasn't broken 2 to 1,000. That means that they have all the time in the world,
and they don't.
Exactly.
We're on a high wire act right now. We know that we cannot run these deficits indefinitely. We know that we cannot just keep printing up extra dollars, and we cannot keep exchanging them for the real goods and real raw materials that other nations have to produce in exchange for this monopoly money called dollars that we're giving them. We know that that process has going to come to an end. The process has already started unwinding. That's really what happened. That was the crisis that started to take place last fall. That was a private sector crisis. That was the private sector not being able to borrow any money. The next crisis will be in the public sector. At some point, somebody, one of our creditors, is going to come along and say, in fact, they've already started talking about this, you know, I don't think we need any more of those Treasury bonds. I think we're okay. We've got our $2 trillion of reserves in the case of China, or we've got our $600 or $700 billion in reserves in the case of Russia or Japan or the Europeans or the folks in the Middle East. We're good. Thanks a lot. Thanks, America. We appreciate all these Treasury bonds, and hopefully we will be able to use them for something other than wallpaper. But we're gonna use our productive capacity to provide for our own citizens. Thanks, but no thanks. We're good.
I think as brokers, all we can do is try to relate it to our clients with historical context, simple analogies. You know, when I was speaking at the Tea Party on July 4th here in Santa Monica, I tried to put it into context for the enthusiastic crowd that was out there. And we look at figures. For example, it was $3.5 trillion to fight World War II. Now, that's CPI-adjusted dollars. So $3.5 trillion, we've spent three times that amount already in money created out of thin air to, you know, bail out the Wall Street guys and to kind of paper over this debacle in the mortgage backed. And so the situation is that, okay, the dollar hasn't completely collapsed yet on the back of $11 trillion. So when is it going to collapse? 15, 20? Well, you can bet one thing. Ben Bernanke is going to push it all the way. He considers himself the ultimate student of the Great Depression, and his opinion is that they did not create enough money there. So his actions are following his word. They don't call him Helicopter Ben for nothing. This is a man who is hell-bent on not letting nominal asset prices fall. So he will print. He will keep printing. And really, if you think about it, he's got no choice. The mess that Greenspan has left him has given him no real alternatives but to print money. So our creditors are out there. They're not blind. They see this. They have plans. You look at the Chinese going out and acquiring corporations, companies, assets all over the world, trying to get rid of their dollars secretly. I mean, they're upping their reserves in gold. And the things that you hear about now is that they, you know, they up their reserves in gold by fivefold over a period, and that doesn't sound like a lot because the base was so small. But you don't know what they're doing right now. Yeah, 3 or 4 years from now, you're going to know what they were doing in 2009. Maybe they were increasing the rate at which reserves are caught are being put into storage. Hey, tell you what, we've got the phones backing up here. Let's go ahead and take a call of Tim in Arizona. Tim, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you, gentlemen?
Very good. How are you today?
I'm actually doing pretty okay. My question is actually very basic. I've read both of Peter's books, Crash Proof and The Bull, and the A Little Book. And in the A Little Book, he refers to services as things like doctor's appointments, therapy sessions, lawyers, and things like that. And in the Crash Proof, he refers to them more in terms of sort of lower end jobs, like burger flippers and retail salespeople, things like that.
Okay.
And my question is, I agree that we have too many services and that we need more manufacturing jobs, but I'm sort of confused on what exactly he's meant by services. So to have fewer services, what does that mean?
Well, think about this. We just had, under the Bush administration, the weakest recovery in terms of jobs that has ever happened in a post-recessionary period. I mean, the jobs that were created during the Bush administration were primarily government sector jobs, which are that's one of the most inefficient and non-productive sectors there. And then we had a lot of service sector jobs. Now, to basically focus in on what the service sector jobs are, you are talking about the burger flippers. You're talking about the type of jobs that aren't actually productive, that aren't creating anything. The type of job that Peter is talking about, the manufacturing type jobs, are when you're actually building something that can create value. Now, if you are in a businessman, you are starting a business where you can employ people. Now, what type of business? The traditional roles, the low-end businesses, aren't necessarily where we need to be focused on. I mean, the American economy is diverse. The American populace is still retains the basic ingenuity. So you're talking about technology. You're talking about different kind of industries where you can create the basis for future employment. I mean, Neeraj, what do you think about that?
Well, I couldn't agree more. My father was in the automobile business back in the late 70s and early 80s. He worked for a dealership of General Motors, and we lived in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time. And so we saw the erosion of the manufacturing capacity in the United States firsthand. My father, unfortunately, because he worked for a domestic automaker, the General Motors, experienced a couple of layoffs during that period because our industry, this is now, remember, 30 years ago, even at that time, our industry was starting to become less and less competitive. And there's some structural reasons for that. A lot of inefficiencies, a lot of taxes, a lot of regulations that were really built up in the economy during the 60s and 70s. Finally started to break the back of U.S. industry starting in the late 70s and early 80s. That process has been going on for 30 years. And we are now reaching the death knell, if you will, of the U.S. economy. I mean, I think, again, using General Motors as an example, this is the largest industrial company in the world. There was a saying many, many years ago, before my time, but close enough in history that we can all sort of appreciate, what was good for General Motors was good for the country. Well, guess what? General Motors, what was once the most largest, powerful industrial company in the world, is bankrupt. So we've had that erosion for 30 years. We have killed the goose that laid the golden egg because of high taxes and high regulations and some other structural issues in the economy. And we need to get those jobs back. And those jobs were basically high-wage, skilled labor jobs. My father was a blue-collar worker. He worked with his hands. He was not sitting in an office somewhere. He was not a real estate agent. He was not a loan broker. He was not, a debt securitizer. He worked with his hands.
One thing I want to point out is, and I'm glad you made the analogy and the description of the automobile industry, because I've been telling clients and speaking out about this for the last several years, that we should not write off even the basic manufacturing businesses like that, stating that we just can't do it as well as the Japanese or the Europeans. There are many, many profitable automobile plants in this country run by Honda, run by Toyota.
That's right.
My hypothesis has been, and I think this will pan out over the course of the next decade or so, that the entire states of Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio, most of the factories that are now sitting idle will be owned by foreign corporations, and there is a trained workforce that is willing to work. They just have been working for inefficient management and overly regulated structures within the not only the city governments, but the state governments and the federal governments, that they don't realize that there is a better way. You're going to have a dollar index, which our firm is projecting to lose at least 50 to 60% of its current value, and that is going to sort of be the tonic, which is going to make it's going to bridge the gap. It's going to make it effective for these foreign companies to come in and invest in the manufacturing base, which is already present. The workforce is there. The property, plant, and equipment, in large part, is there. And so, you know, that's kind of what Peter talks about, and that's the direction that we need to head as a country.
Yeah, basic manufacturing. I'm talking to you on a phone that has an AT&T label on it, but was made in Asia. I'm interacting with our folks in the control room over a computer that has a Dell label on it, but was made in Taiwan. Basic manufacturing is the lifeblood of a good economy. It made me almost sick to my stomach a few months ago when I heard, I believe it was the president, President Obama, who I think is probably an intelligent man. I just think he's colossally misinformed. Who said that credit is the lifeblood of the economy. And I almost just wanted to cry because I said, come on, man. What do you mean credit is the lifeblood of the economy? Savings, production, those are the lifeblood of the economy, not credit. Credit is just something that it's a tool that you can use if you're a businessman and you want to engage in some investment. Consumer credit, I think, is very harmful to the consumer and to the economy as a whole. In any event, Tim, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for being patient. We're going to move on to Julio in Ohio. You are on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm here in Ohio. I get paid next week, so I'll be sending something to Shift Campaign.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate your support.
I have a question for you guys. I want to read you something from Forbes.com first. It says the Federal Reserve Bank of New York holds the prize as the world's biggest owner, known stockpile of gold, some 550,000 glistening bars. The stuff is buried deep into the bedrock of Lower Manhattan, blah, 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 blah. Just 2 to 5% of it is owned by the U.S. government. The rest is owned by foreign countries. Now, my question is, I support Ron Paul and the whole movement to have backed by gold, our currency backed by gold and everything. But by moving from a gold standard, aren't we just in effect changing from one monetary control to another? Because both will be controlled by the central bank. So without getting rid of the central banks, aren't we just moving from one form of control to another? I mean, if they control the gold, does it really matter if we're under a gold standard?
Well, first of all, I could not agree with you more that the Federal Reserve has been one of the most destructive institutions in our country's history. If you look back at what the value of a single dollar was back in 1913, 1914, when the Federal Reserve was first being dreamt up by those geniuses in Washington, and you compare a dollar then to what a dollar can buy now, the Federal Reserve has single-handedly destroyed 98% of the purchasing power of that dollar. So as far as destroying the American economy, you know, if we wanted to put up a hall of fame for people who have destroyed the American economy, the first candidate for that hall of fame would be the Federal Reserve. Absolutely no doubt about it in my mind. With regards to the gold standard, you know, the benefit of a gold standard, and this is very, very important, this is probably the single most important concept that we can talk about. The value of a gold standard is that the piece of paper that we're carrying around in our pockets represent a tangible asset, and it forces the central government, and if there is a Federal Reserve, the central bank, to be restricted in how many of those pieces of paper that they can print up. Think of being in Monopoly, okay? There's a fixed amount of of those little properties around the board. There's a bunch of hotels that you can put on. There's some houses you can put on. But there's a relatively fixed amount of stuff on the monopoly board. That's similar to an economy. On a year-to-year basis, yeah, you can put in another plant. You can put in another road. You can put in something else that's productive. You can manufacture some things. But relatively speaking, economic growth, at least in the United States, has averaged, even during this phony period, about 3% a year. That means from year to year, you have basically the same amount of stuff in the economy. But monetary growth in the United States has been well into double digits for many, many of those years. Well, what does that mean? What that means is, going back to that monopoly board, it just means that one of the players is reaching into that bank and ever so slightly taking some dollars out of that bank and putting it in front of himself and then going out and spending it. That player has been the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury Department. They're reaching into that bank, printing up more monopoly money, and then going out and buying and spending stuff.
Well, one way to look at it is you take all the gold that's ever come out of the earth. I mean, 5,000 years of history, the gold that's hanging around women's necks in India or sitting in bars supposedly under New York. I mean, let's face it, Fort Knox hasn't even been audited since 1959, so we're not really sure if that gold is there. But let's just take every ounce of gold that's ever come out of the earth and assume that it hasn't been used industrially, because most of it is actually been unused. It's precious metal. It's not something that is used up. So it's all there somewhere. So 5,000 years of gold, what that is, like a 23 by 23 meter cube. Do you imagine this gold sitting on the outfield of Dodger Stadium here in L.A.? I mean, that's how precious it is. How much bigger can that cube be expanded by on a yearly basis? Really, at current rates, it's 1.5% a year. That's how precious it is. And it's priced in dollars. Now,
am I muted?
Sorry. No, I can hear you.
If the push is to, you know, return to a gold standard, how I understand everything you're saying, I totally agree. But if the push is to return to a gold standard, but that gold is controlled by central banks,
mm-hmm.
what good is that unless you? Unless the real push is to eliminate central banking entirely, because if it's still controlled by the central banks, you know,
sure,
it doesn't matter.
Take that one.
Well, I was just going to say that you're bringing up an excellent point, and it's actually one of the topics that that we've spoken about, that actually Hamid has spoken about at the Tea Party recently, which is H.R. 1207, Audit the Fed.
Hey,
I could not agree with you more that the current Federal Reserve has absolutely no credibility when it comes to protecting the value of our currency. And that includes both the fiat currency, this monopoly money that we've got in our pockets, as well as sound money. I mean, they're the ones who took us off sound money. They're the party who engaged in the systematic theft of value from the American people over the last 100 years or so.
Not to get off topic, but I believe H.R. 1207 has crossed the threshold. We have over 250 co-sponsors.
Yeah, the Democrats, unfortunately, I'm not an ideologue. I believe in ideas and people, not parties. But the Democrats in this case appear to be preventing it from coming to a floor vote. It's Mrs. Pelosi and her good friends in the Democratic Party that are preventing that from moving forward.
Yeah, we're working on Driehaus here, our congressman in Cincinnati, Ohio. So hopefully, if anybody's listening, you know,
mm-hmm.
we're still trying to give him a push.
We've got to get the word out that we, you know, you're bringing up a very good point, which is that we have got to audit that Federal Reserve. We've got to open up the hood.
That is step one.
Yeah, that is step one. We've got to restore sound money. In any event, Julio, thank you very much.
Hope we
were able to answer your question today. Let's move on now. To Grayson in Colorado. Thank you for waiting patiently. I know you've been on the hold for a while. How can we help you today? How are you doing today?
I'm good, guys. How are you doing?
Good, good. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yeah, you got it right.
Great. My wife
and I are big fans of Red of All Peter's stuff. We listen to you guys every week, and we're really interested in the gold topic, and it was interesting that you guys brought it up tonight. And I had a couple questions. One about the Perth Mint. When you I do a little research on Perth Mint. You bring up some stuff, and you see some things that are not too positive about it, you know, like that they can't fulfill their orders and that kind of stuff. And I'm wondering if that's just somebody with a...
I think I'll take that one.
Grind on that, or...
Grayson,
yeah.
Let's talk about that. The Perth Mint is an entity which has been under continuous operation for well over 100 years. Now, the event that I believe you're referring to happened around the time of turmoil, November, December of last year, and the Perth Mint had to come out and state, because they've gotten unprecedented orders for fabrication, believe it or not, a lot of those orders came out of Switzerland, which is known to have a lot of refining capacity, but the demand for bars was so great, so incredibly great, that between the Swiss orders and a lot of orders which came out of Saudi Arabia, the Perth Mint had to focus on the large denominated bars and just get that 24/7 operation pumping out those bars, and temporarily, for several weeks, I believe, back order the smaller denomination coins. Now, that was a blip that they took care of, but it's not because they did not have the gold there. It's
okay.
Because they were running 24/7 to satisfy the tremendous demand. And you're going to see more of that. There is no other conclusion you can draw that if people want gold, that the demand is going to increase. There's only a limited amount of refining capacity worldwide, and so you've got mines shipping the unrefined product into the Perth Mint on a daily basis. The gold is in process. They also are refining silver and platinum. So when it comes to these points where the system is a little bit stressed, they've got to make a conscious decision and prioritize those orders. So that's simply what the situation was. There
okay.
was one individual who I'm not going to name who literally was trying to claim the gold wasn't there. And, you know, I talked to Peter every single day. I mean, I remember that morning very well. He said, look, I called that guy up, and I called him out. I said, I'm going to go with you. And I'm going to pay for your ticket, first class. We're going to Perth, and we're going to go look at the gold. And the person backed out. So without giving publicity to anybody, I'm not going to name names, but that is exactly what happened. You can take it from me. Literally after Peter talked to the guy, I talked to Peter within the hour, and he said, you know, the guy's not going to go because, I mean, I called his bluff. So we fully stand behind it. Not that... there aren't other ways to have gold. It is one way that I think everybody should have, though. I mean, let's face it. You can have gold in your box here at your local bank, and you got to worry about confiscation. You can have various mining shares, and then, of course, you've got geopolitical risk and management
sure.
risk. But I think that everybody should keep a simple philosophy like I do. I keep my gold spread around. There's no one event that can take me down. And so I believe that if you follow that systematic way of keeping that insurance policy and then incrementally keep adding into it, Perth Mint's a great way to diversify your physical gold holdings.
That sounds great. And that kind of leads me to my other question is being in gold manufacturing, I've found a thing that's called, it's an ETF called GDX.
GDX
is
an ETF,
big gold mining
North American
sort of
gold miners, the largest capitalized stocks. You're talking about Barrick, Newmont, Kinross, et cetera, Goldcorp.
Yes. I wonder what you guys' thoughts are on or something like that, trying to get on the gold manufacturing side of things.
See, the gold miners are going to give you the leverage to gold price. Let me put it in simple terms. Let's say you're a gold
okay.
company, and your cost of getting the gold out of the ground is $500 an ounce, and gold is trading at $800 an ounce. Okay, profitable company. Making $300 an ounce profit. Now, gold at 800 could go to 1200 and onward, which is what we're projecting. Now,
right.
part of the reason that gold rises to 1200 will be inflationary, and there might be energy costs, labor costs, et cetera, going up with it. So maybe the cost of getting that gold out of the ground goes from 500 to 550, so incrementally increases a bit. But the margin at $1,200 gold and $550 cost of production has increased dramatically. And that is what happens. They call it leverage to the gold price. So
okay.
as gold increases, the cost to mine it are relatively fixed. And so a gold stock will go up at double, triple, quadruple the rate of the physical gold. So, I mean, if your question is should you own the gold miners, absolutely yes. I would take it even a step further. I would go and leverage the research from our mining analyst. I mean, the other day, Thomas Tan was in our office here in L.A., and we were looking at another opportunity where we were funding a mining company. These guys are on the ground floor. They're visiting these companies, and so you can take advantage of the Euro-Pacific Capital Research and buy the premier companies, not the ones that are just an index of the largest capitalized stocks, which might go, you know, which are going to go up with gold, but the companies that are not as well known, the ones companies that trade in Hong Kong and Australia and Canada,
sure.
That's where we can really add value. And a lot of these companies already pay dividends. So,
okay.
You know, definitely I would encourage you to do so.
Excellent.
Great.
Well, appreciate
thanks
you guys
for joining us. Appreciate your patience. David, in the beautiful city of New York, you are going to be on the air here. How are things in the Big Apple there?
Hello?
Hello, is this David in New York City? You're on the air.
Yes, this is David. Hi, very good on the show. I just wanted to say a couple things.
Sure.
I was very happy to hear in Peter's recent video blog that Peter's going to be trying to run for the Senate, and everyone out there should contribute money, without a doubt.
Website is shifforsenate.com, shifforsenate.com.
And to be specific, it's an exploratory committee, and what that means is, and I'll just use Peter's exact words at the Freedom Fest conference. He described this. He said he's exploring the possibility, and the only really way to know that is to gauge the interest. I mean, he is polling well against Dodd, but there's the entrenched Republicans that he has to face first. And so he's looking to explore the interest. So go to shiftforsenate.com. And you'll have the ability to express your support for that.
Yes, I agree that the Republican primary will be more challenging than the general. Also, I don't know if people out there have seen Peter's recent appearance on CNBC with Daniel Neal, and I just wanted to say that Daniel Neal is just completely intellectually dishonest and so disrespectful to Peter. He preempts him for 2 minutes before Peter even goes on, and I was very happy to see, I was getting upset watching, and then when I watched Peter's video blog later that night, I was happy to see him respond to his ridiculousness. And
I got to tell you, the reason that both Neeraj and I laugh, both of us have known Peter for over 20 years, and, you know, he's immune to that stuff. People are, when they don't have a response for somebody who makes a lot more sense than they do,
they go ad hominem and they attack the messenger all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he's been right on. He's seen the problems in the U.S. economy far before the high-paid PhDs and Wall Street analysts and the typical egghead CFPs and the guys will show you the pie charts looking back 10 or 20 years. Peter's always looking forward 5, 10, 20 years. So they just can't understand what he's even thinking. But that's what makes him such a genius. I mean, he's been able to foresee these events far before anyone else.
And you know, to Peter's credit, he doesn't. Amon mentioned, I've known him for quite a few years, and he doesn't allow the criticism to rattle him. You know, he doesn't really attack people. He doesn't play the screaming matches games. He doesn't talk over people. He just lays out his case, and that kind of guides, he kind of sets the standard for the entire firm. So, you know, we don't want to bash anybody. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there with a lot of opinions, and Peter has been fortunate to have the opportunity to speak in the media, and, you know, we just want to continue to get the word out. David, thank you very much for your comments.
I was wondering if you had, if anyone out there or you guys had read the Matt Taibbi article in Rolling Stones called The Great American Bubble Machine.
Oh, I've had a couple people send me the link. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. But
I just wanted to mention, you know, it was getting huge play in the liberal media. MSNBC and Huffington Post were all over it talking how great a piece of journalism it was.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much the article claims that Goldman Sachs is responsible for the bubble of the Great Depression, the NASDAQ bubble, the housing bubble, and the recent spike in oil prices. And not once in the entire article are the words Federal Reserve, Greenspan, Bernanke, or inflation mentioned once. I just, as a former Obama supporter who thought Peter Schiff was right and then asked, what was Peter studying and listening to and reading about that no one else in the mainstream media or political world was even paying attention to? And I said, I want to know what Peter's studying. And I'll be happy to
take your call off the air. You can give us a call anytime, and we can discuss it with you. Because if we start talking about what caused the Great Depression, then and I will probably be talking our heads off for the next couple of hours.
Yeah,
so give us a call anytime. It was great talking to you. Thanks for the call.
Terry in Florida, thank you so much for being patient. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Enjoying. How's the weather out there in Florida?
Well, it's not like in L.A.
Hey, did they get that shuttle launch today? I know they were waiting
extremely
for a window of opportunity there.
Yes.
Okay.
Great. So what can we do for you?
Hey, just a quick question. Do you recommend, I have the unallocated gold in the Perth Mint through your company, and at any point in time, would you recommend just going to allocated?
No, actually, I wouldn't. Because you've got the flawless track record, because you've got it's owned and operated by the government of Western Australia, because you've got the insurance from Lloyd's of London, I don't think you need to incur the expense. What you need to do is, at some point, if you think you're going to be going and actually taking delivery, just try to plan that out a couple weeks in advance. You just you talk to your representative here at your capital. And they can arrange for that to be fabricated, and then you can go take possession of it. There is no urgency that I see with the Perth Mint that you would need to keep it in a segregated status. Of course, if you want to, it's not a problem.
Sure.
Go ahead and put numbered stamped bars in a box with your name on it, and you can go to Perth anytime and verify it, visit your gold, so to speak, make a vacation out of it. We've had clients do that, and uniformly the response has been very positive.
Okay, good. Yeah, that was my, and I know you talked earlier about gold, but I just wasn't able to hear that part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm what you would call a gold bug. I mean, it's, more accurately, it's probably to call me a silver bug. I've just been investing in these markets for quite some time. I do a lot of trading with the mining shares, but everybody needs to have that foundation, which is what you've done with the Perth Mint. So, that's good. You should incrementally over time keep adding to it, keep a plan. And then you can, after that, you've got that foundation built, you can start getting the foreign dividend paying stocks and the mining shares and all the other things. But definitely stick with that physical goal. I think you've done a great thing.
Okay, good. So start really diversifying into like maybe some ETFs or something.
ETFs, I mean, really, if you're with our firm, you should take advantage of our research. I mean, Peter pays these guys to literally get their feet on the ground all over the world. You're talking about Australia, Canada, within China. These guys are visiting the mines. We only pick the cream of the crop. I mean, Euro Pacific Capital has a lot of visibility right now. We've done some capital raises for some companies that have been phenomenally successful. For issues that... if you're one of our accredited investors, you'll have access to where you can actually get, an interest payment with the ownership of the mining shares. So, keep that in mind. Talk to your broker. If you do not yet have a brokerage account, certainly you can call in to either the toll-free line or one of the West Coast offices, which have brokers currently in them. And thanks for taking the time to reach out to us today. You have a great day.
Mauricio in Brazil, another place I'd love to visit. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you. Congratulations for your nice video blog, okay?
Thank you so much. What's your question?
Great show, I'm sorry.
Thank you. So what can we do for you today?
Say again, please?
What's your question, Mauricio?
Okay, fine. I am... Since the starting of the, the most dramatic part of the financial crisis, since the middle of last year, I am watching very carefully here in Brazil and looking into the many different sources, like, for example, Mises.org, you know, all the best information we can pick up in the internet.
Good,
sure.
Good. So you're in the learning process.
Again?
So you're in the learning process. That's good. It's good
yeah.
to be.
Yeah. And my question is about the forecast for the so-called BRIC, B-R-I-C countries.
Brazil, Russia, India, China, for those people listening in who didn't quite catch that. We think that the GDP growth in those markets is going to continue to greatly exceed the more mature markets. You need to have a good portion of your assets allocated towards the growing parts of the world, the BRIC countries. The volatility in those markets is going to continue. One of the things that we've been doing for our clients is putting them into a lot of Brazilian bonds recently. That's been an extremely popular way to play it. There are AAA-rated instruments where you can get exposure to the Brazilian currency. Within China, the best way is probably to play it through the Hong Kong Exchange. Our analysts focus on that very, very carefully, so there are tremendous ideas there that can pay you a very robust dividend and give you the upside to that growing GDP within China.
In fact, we've got a terrific new way to invest in China. I'm not going to get into too much detail, but we're in the process of rolling out a mutual fund that focuses on the exciting growth opportunities in China. I think perhaps when Peter returns next week, we can talk about it a bit more. But watch your email and watch the video blog and tune into the radio show for some more details. But that's something that we're very, very excited about. We've got the infrastructure and the folks and the team being lined up now. And that's definitely something that that we are focusing on for the future.
But thanks a lot for the phone call, and you know, we look forward to having you as a client.
Mark in Japan, another international caller. This is terrific. I love the consistency with the international approach. Exactly.
Yeah.
How are you doing today? How are things in Japan?
Beautiful. The economy seems to still being quite all right. I mean, compared to other countries, or what I read in the newspaper, at least.
Well, you've got the savings. That's definitely a good buffer when there's uncertain economic times.
Yep.
Sure.
And
I think Japan, that will be an issue at some point. They will either have to go through some level of inflation or some... I think they're printing money to allow the yen to not go too abruptly against the dollar, which keeps kind of the currency in line with the dollar.
GDP, but in aggregate, when you include the household savings and the savings at the corporate level, I mean, the corporate balance sheets have improved dramatically in the last decade. So you are right, but at the same time, we look at vis-a-vis the U.S., we still see Japan as a favorable alternative, especially with the PEs becoming compressed over the last two decades. I mean, you're talking about companies that are trading at 3 and 4 times earnings right now, so it really makes the risk versus reward equation from our standpoint look very favorable.
Sure, and I think ultimately the economy will be more resilient in terms of capacity to adapt to different environments. I have two questions, the quick questions. The first question is, there are different kinds of taxes. Of course, inflation is the most insidious form of tax we know of, but let's just talk about the others, the tolls, tobacco, capital gain, inheritance, consumption tax. I think Peter suggested one day he'd go for consumption tax as his favorite one. How do you see taxes? What would be your favorite one if you had to, assuming you had to remove cash from the society, assuming that's what we decided we'd do as a society, we'd go a bit social, we'd put in for rainy days. Where would you get your money from? Out of which pocket of the society would you take it from?
It's a tough call because I'm in a similar tax bracket to Peter, so we have a viewpoint that we're looking from self-interest, where if 55 to 60% of our income is going in the form of taxation, the incentives for us to employ people become reduced. I mean, I'd rather just, I live here, looking out my window right now, I'm looking at the Santa Monica Bay, I'd rather just go lie down on the beach than put in an extra 4 or 5 hours to the office when I know it's just going to the government. So with that being said, you've, of course, got to look at the other side of the equation, the policies that they're proposing right now are literally scary, and how are we going to pay for those? Well, that's probably the wrong way to look at it. I mean, we got to change the policies is probably the better solution than promising all these things and then figuring out how to tax.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. In fact, it really kind of irks me how much time people in the media and the politicians spend dreaming up new taxes. I mean, I've just looked out on the internet today, and there's another new tax that they're planning to pay for health care. It doesn't affect very many people, but they're talking about a 5% plus tax on income on folks who make incomes of $1 million a year or more. Now, obviously, those are people who are very, very wealthy, but don't think that in a few years that number won't be reduced to 900,000 and 800,000 and 300,000 and 150,000. Pretty soon, everyone's paying it. So
what would be your favorite?
It really drives me a little crazy to hear people talk about taxation. What we really need to do is focus on the tremendous amount of spending that we're doing in this country at the government level. I mean, Peter, when we were at Freedom Fest, Hemant and I were at Freedom Fest last week with Peter in Las Vegas, and we were at his private luncheon that he had for a few select clients and some other friends. And, you know, he said back during the Great Depression, government was very tiny relative to the size of the economy. He didn't quote the figure, but I looked it up later. It was below 10%. Right now, government is well in excess of 20% of GDP and climbing. So instead of focusing on taxation, what we really need to talk about, the debate that we really need to have, is let's cut out some of this ridiculous spending that we've got in the country.
I agree with the spending cuts. That's definitely an issue. But what I'm saying is, even if the government was to be 5% of the economy, I'd like to know what in what order do you approach taxes? Which taxes?
You know, I'll tell you, at 5%, I don't think there's anyone in the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, the Libertarian Party that would object to paying 5% of his income in taxes.
No, he's actually talking about if we brought the government as a percentage of GDP down to 5%.
Yeah.
What would be the taxes that
what
you
What type
would
of tax? Whether it's a VAT or a consumption economy?
The theory on taxes is that when you tax something, you get less of it. And when you subsidize something, you get more of it. So if you want a nation, as I do, and as Peter does, and as Hemant does, if you want a nation of people who are out there saving money, people who are out there producing, then I don't see how you can have taxes on savings and taxes on production. One of the most shocking things to me is the double taxation of dividends in this country versus the ability for companies to write off interest payments on debt. So in other words, we are encouraging actively through government policy the taking on of debt and the non-payment of dividends. That's why you've seen the dividend yield on the S&P 500 drop below 3% since the early 1990s. We have totally and entirely geared our society towards taxing and spending and borrowing and consuming instead of savings and production. Listen, we only have got about a minute or two left. I wanted to just wrap up with some thoughts. First of all, I want to thank all the callers this evening for joining us. It's been a very, very exciting hour for me. It's my first opportunity to participate in this show. And we're looking forward to having Peter back return with us next week. Hemant, any closing ideas from you?
Well, yeah, I'm also very excited about the emergence of Andrew Schiff. I mean, I think he did a great
great
deal last week at the Freedom Fest show.
Team, great continuity in place.
Yes, the Schiff brothers are alive and well, and we look forward to having them back on the show.
SchiffForSenate.com. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week.